Good evening, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome once again to Women's Voices. I'd like to share a quote with you that I came across the other day. It's an African saying, "Without tears in the eyes, there is no rainbow in the heart." We can all probably remember a moment when something or someone said or did something that touched us deeply. And suddenly there were those tears and that feeling of the heart opening. And now a little music from my CD, The Voice of the Mother, Indian Maiden. I recorded this myself in my little cottage at Stinson Beach many moons ago, deep in my journey, and then added a second part in Peter Temple's studio maybe 8 years ago. One day I intend to add a third part. My guest this evening is Ronnie James, who created Mendocino County's only wildlife rehab center, Woodlands Wildlife, 26 years ago. Woodlands Wildlife rescues, rehabilitates, and releases injured and orphaned wildlife and provides education programs for schools, nonprofits, or agencies throughout coastal Mendocino. Ronnie writes, I fell in love with the Mendocino coast as a 9-year-old when I came to camp at the Mendocino Woodlands and visited Homer and Lil Drinkwater's Remedy Store in Mendocino for an ice cream. I stood on a boardwalk sidewalk to watch a man ride down the dirt street on horseback and tie up to a hitching rail in front of the store. I knew I'd found that spot on earth where I belonged. But between 1951 and her move to Mendocino in 1987, Ronnie finished college at UC Berkeley, worked as an emergency room and laboratory medical technologist in Modesto, California, retired from a 17-year marriage, and moved to Davis, where she raised her 2 sons as a single mother. When they were both off to college, I knew my time had come and moved to Mendocino, where I've now lived for 26 years. She continues, the wildlife program started by accident a week after I moved here when I visited veterinarian Jan Dietrich's office to get cat food. And he showed me a permanently disabled great horned owl he had rescued. It was Woodlands Wildlife's first bird. During the next 26 years, Woodlands Wildlife grew into Mendocino County's only wildlife rehab center, and in her free time, James wrote the National Historic Landmark nomination and served as president of the board of directors for the Mendocino Woodlands Outdoor Center for 13 years. In 2008, she led the community drive to raise $62,000 to restore the Little River Improvement Club, Little River's 125-year-old Good Templars Lodge and Community Center building, and opened it as a museum and meeting hall. Ronnie's book, Touching Wings, Touching Wild, True Stories of Rescue and Return to the Wild, is a collection of touching and humorous stories. Ginny Rorby, author of Dolphin Sky, writes, wife, mother, society diva and career woman, James emerges as the creator of a rural wildlife rescue facility providing medical care to injured and owls and swimming lessons for orphaned river otters. Informative, fascinating, life-altering. Welcome, Ronnie, to Women's Voices.
Well, thank you, Janie. I've never quite heard myself spoken of like that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, it's nice to hear one spoken of in that way when it's all due. You know, my first question to you and to all my guests, given that this is Women's Voices, is what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, aside from the major part of having given me life and raised me for the first 18 years of my life, my mother came from abject poverty. And when I was growing up, the most important thing for her to tell me was that I could do anything I wanted, be anything I wanted in this life. She gave me faith in myself, insisted that I get an education, and she made many sacrifices so that I could have that education. And I think the other thing that she taught me was to believe in the goodness of every human being, and that every human being can be what they want or do what they want, accomplish what they want.
That's quite a gift.
It was a big gift, yes.
And you have been so... the things you've done are quite amazing, and my sense of you, obviously, is that you do everything you do it very well.
Thank you.
Yes, and I imagine that came from your mother as well.
My mother did stress, She stressed being good at what you do, it's true, and And I think as an adult, and all adults, still strive to please their parents.
Could you talk a little bit about your career as a medical technologist and how that came about? And also, obviously, music has played an important part in your life. You have sung in choirs, still do, I believe, mm-hmm. and you've played an instrument. What instrument are you playing in a local group?
I don't play any instrument anymore. I used to play harpsichord and other keyboards and Irish drums, wow. the boron and hammer dulcimer. And now I play my voice with the choir.
Great. So may I ask what your father, how he spent his time?
My father was self-employed. He sold home furnishings from his car. And he made enough to make us a very comfortable home and put me through college. Huh. And we had a very traditional family. My mother stayed home, took care of us. I have a brother, so my mother stayed home and made the home for the children, and my father came home at 6 o'clock and wanted dinner on the table. And
got it.
he was very active with his family, though. His family was very important to him. And I had always had an interest in medicine. When I was growing up, I was told women can't be doctors. You need to be a nurse, and you really don't want to be a nurse because that's a hard job. You want to do something else. So I ended up in medical technology. Hmm. And my first job in Modesto was in a very large county hospital, and there were three of us on duty at night. There was a doctor, there was a nurse, and myself, the medical technologist. And if somebody was having a baby, or five people were having babies, five women were giving birth, we each took one. And so I learned a lot. If we had a surgery, an emergency surgery in the middle of the night, I got to scrub in and help with the surgery. And there was a lot of on-the-job training to do many kinds of things that I was not really qualified to do in the job that I had. But it was very useful. It was very educational.
And of course, it's been helpful in your current life.
Totally transferred over to all the animal care that I do.
I don't know what a medical technologist is.
Laboratory work.
So
we worked, doing all the laboratory tests and transfusions and all of that. In the old days, used to be done by hand, and it's now all done by machine.
Mm-hmm. And so how did music come into your life?
I think music came into my life because our piano was locked when I was a child. And the frustration I had, because I always wanted to do something with that piano, It presented itself when I was in my 30s and I learned how to play the harpsichord. I met someone who taught harpsichord, and she taught me. I went out and found a harpsichord and learned how to play the keyboard and the harpsichord. And I think that the love of music was always there as a child, but I was never able to fulfill it. So I do think, though, that in order to be a really good musician, people need to start when they're very young. It's not something that I've never been a good musician. And I've always thought it was because I really didn't start when I was very young.
Hmm. Could you move up to your microphone just a little bit?
Is this better?
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Well, it says too bad. You had the piano there and weren't able to use it. That's sad.
Well, except maybe if I'd had access to it, I would not have enjoyed music so much as an adult.
Well, was somebody singing? Was there music? Were you hearing music? I mean,
my father loved to sing. My father sang on the radio when he was a child.
Uh-huh.
When he was about 10 years old. There it is.
Yeah. Oh, how wonderful. So then you heard him. He must have sung through your life, too.
Oh, he did. We could not go to a movie without my father singing along with the stars.
Wonderful. Oh, that's great. That's lovely. I know you have some excerpts picked out to read from your book. By the way, before that, as I'm thinking, I realize I have no idea what the Little River's 125-year-old Good Templar's Lodge And community center is, or where it is?
It's the Little River Improvement Club. It is what looks like a little white house just before you go into those tight curves before Van Dam Beach. It's kind of across the street from what used to be Rachel's Inn and is now the Cobbler's Walk Inn.
Now, what road are you speaking on?
On Highway 1.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Most people, it's invisible to most people because as you're either driving up from Van Dam or driving south, your eyes are on that tight curve that you're about to make a turn onto. It's natural if you're driving to want to look at the road because the road is suddenly going down and around a corner. And if you blink, you'll miss the Little River Improvement Club. It's been standing there for 126 years. That's where everyone in Little River voted since 1885.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I'm driving up the highway from south from Mendocino.
South.
Yes, and so I come to the, where the, at Little River, where there is the gas station, the delicatessen.
Nope, you've gone way too far.
Oh, really?
There's that nice long straightaway with the eucalyptus trees, and on your left right. is Glendevin Inn, and then there's a long fence. And then, again, on your left is the Little River Improvement Club, set back from the road just a little bit, maybe 20 feet.
Huh.
But then, instantly, you're making a right turn to go down the hill towards Van Dam Park.
Right. Oh, for heaven's sakes.
It's there.
And you've put a lot of energy into it.
It was a wonderful old building. I sort of cut my teeth on the Mendocino Woodlands, which I did a lot of work trying to do grant writing to restore the woodlands, was not very successful at that. But then the Little River Improvement Club was about to fall to rack and ruin there, so that was the next step.
Well, the Mendocino Woodlands is where Lark Camp is and where people, mm-hmm. and everyone loves it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been was it going to fade away if you didn't do work?
On the building or the woodlands?
I'm assuming it's the building that you...
The Improvement Club building didn't have a foundation, and it was sagging and probably would not have lived too much longer if we didn't put a foundation under it.
Actually, no, I meant the woodlands.
Okay.
Where our Lark Camp is.
Well, it was built in 1938, and I had attended it since about 1952. I've been a camper out there, and I think anybody that goes out to the woodlands will leave their heart there. I have never met anyone that went out there that did not feel a bond and a great love for the place. And mine sort of became a passion as I grew up and got older. My children went to school, I went to camp there, and I went to cook at the camp that they went to.
How wonderful. How simply wonderful.
It was. It's a great place.
And it's going strong.
It is. Oh, it's going very strong. It is very successful.
I would like to read this paragraph that's at the beginning of your book and then want to hear from you. And your book is wonderful and it's filled with lovely stories and funny stories and delightful stories.
Thank you.
But from the author, just a segment of this. You write, "There's nothing magical about observing and appropriately relating to wild animals. If you take a little quiet time to watch your bird feeder, your backyard, an empty lot, sit in the park, or spend time quietly sitting anywhere in the outdoors, you too will see what I've seen. And after you read this book, you'll recognize and understand what you're seeing. It is my intentions that reader come away feeling good about themselves and secure in their knowledge of how to relate to and enjoy wildlife to its fullest." Beautiful. Okay, what are we going to hear? Before you say that, excuse me one moment, okay. To say this is Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner, and I'm here with my guest, Ronnie James, who has written a lovely book, Touching Wings, Touching Wild, who is right here in our community.
Well, I thought I would read a little bit about the fawns that we received. They were one of the first things that come in, and everybody sees deer and they see fawns, and I think everybody likes them unless they're inside their garden eating their plants. The first fawn arrived in a burlap sack in the back of a station wagon shared with a barking dog, loud music blaring on the radio, and human voices laughing and chattering excitedly. "It's so sweet, it just goes to sleep whenever we pet it," the woman told me. Yeah. Truth be told, it was so terrified, it fainted every time it was touched. I carried the fawn to a quiet, dark stall in the barn, placed it in a bed of straw, and closed the door, hoping it hadn't gone so far into shock it would never regain consciousness. It was very small, maybe 16 inches tall, and the stump of its umbilical cord was still attached. We're all familiar with deer. Some of us see them as a potential meal through the sights of a rifle. Others see them as gentle, mystery creatures roaming the forests. And everyone recognizes Bambi and Rudolph. Scientifically, deer are prey animals, lunch for predators. They are the part of the food chain that provides a meal for meat-eating carnivores, including humans. An adult deer has a strong scent easily followed by a predator, but a fawn has almost none. So the doe leaves her fawn alone in a secluded nest or under a bush. Inherited memory tells the fawn to remain motionless, its spotted coat blending with the surroundings until its mother returns to feed and clean it. Aside from being on the lunch menu, people and dogs create the biggest problems for fawns. Humans often find fawns in their nests and, thinking them abandoned, rescue them. If a fawn is brought to us within a few days and we know exactly where it was found, we can return it to its nest. Then we must leave the area because the doe will not approach if a person is anywhere nearby. The fawn will be so hungry and insistent, it will force itself on the doe even as she shies away from the scent of humans on her baby. Eventually, she'll allow the fawn to nurse and lick off the offending smell. It was early May, and the people who brought my first fawn had found it in its nest while they were out hiking. They assumed it was abandoned since it didn't run away and no adult deer was in sight. They brought it to their motel room where their dog and an assortment of guests visited and touched it. To a fawn, being touched by humans is akin to our being intimately examined by space aliens. Fainting, or playing possum, is a defense used by many prey species since motion is the primary stimulant for a predator. The people were traveling and had picked up the fawn somewhere several hundred miles north of here, so I couldn't return it to its mother. "It's so precious," the woman said as she edged towards the door. "I don't know how its mother could have left it alone like that, but we're sure glad you're here to take care of it." The fawn had been without food or water for at least 24 hours, so I filled a squeeze bottle with warm, reconstituted doe's milk and peeked in. Frozen in fear, it stood in the far corner of the stall. As I approached, it closed its eyes and crumbled in a slow-motion faint to the floor. Silently, I knelt and dribbled a few drops of warm milk on its lips. I saw its nostrils twitch ever so slightly. Then it licked. I dripped a little more licking, and a little swallowing. A little more milk, a little more swallowing, and eventually the tongue licked at the strange container providing the warm, familiar taste. I did not touch the fawn, and I made no sound. It did not open its eyes. A silent contract between a terrified wild baby and a compassionate parrot predator. Eyes closed, it sucked and swallowed until the bottle was empty. I eventually got three fawns that first year. And they all grew up, and they were all released close to my house. And I saw them for many months after that as they grew up and went about their lives becoming deer. And we've since, Woodlands Wildlife, this happened many years ago, and Woodlands Wildlife has since opened a fawn facility, the only one in Mendocino County, and we have a woman who runs our fawn facility on her property in Philo. And if we can't return the deer, to the fawn, to its mother, then she is able to raise it. I have often say the only abandoned fawn is the one standing next to its dead mother by the highway. Does will not abandon their babies. Don't pick them up. Leave them there.
That's a beautiful story. How many volunteers, I'm sure it changes through the years, how many volunteers do you have?
We're a very small facility. There's only four of us. And that's over 20 years that we've had four. We just never have enough animals at one time to utilize and teach volunteers. And the laws have changed around doing wildlife rescue. It is required that volunteers spend a certain amount of time in a training course before they can have any contact with the animals. And we aren't big enough to do anything like that. They do offer wonderful training courses at Wild Care in Marin. And if people graduate from that, they are then allowed to help and be a volunteer with a wildlife facility. But even with that, even if we have a trained volunteer, there just aren't that many hours of work every day that require that much staff. Most of the work at this point is administrative. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me because over the years, I am now required to have about 8 licenses from the state and federal government and make 8 reports, and there's just a tremendous amount of paperwork that we now have to do in order to operate a facility. There's an awful lot of laws that have come into being around wildlife rescue and rehab.
That must be a lot to take care of. That's the administrative part you're speaking of.
Yes, it's more to take care of than the animals, actually.
Wow. In the beginning, it was just you with this big horned owl. That was your first
bird, came from Jan Dietrich's office.
And you had to build a cage.
Hired a carpenter and we built a cage.
Big, right?
Well, it was big, but it wasn't big enough. The cage was about 6 feet by 2 feet, just wide enough for this owl to be in. And very quickly I realized that I had to make something much larger than that. It worked for this particular owl because she couldn't fly, so she didn't ever spread her wings. But we are required to have cages that are 12 feet square. And so I have 3 tiers of cages with 4 cages in each tier. And the cages, most of them measure 12 feet square and about 8 to 10 feet high. Mm. And the cages have to be predator-proof. There. Does that help? The cages have to be predator-proof. All of our cages, we build the cage, and underneath the cage we have to wrap the entire cage in wire cloth to keep anything from digging in from underneath or coming in through the top. And cages have to have a roof over half of them, and they have to have special perches. And I do large birds. And every single bird and everything, every other species, every wild animal has very specific requirements for it to be comfortable. And at this point, I have a blind owl, and I have an owl that's paralyzed on one side. Hamlet, who has been with me now for 26 years. She was the original owl from Jan Dietrich.
Wow.
People always say, well, how long are they going to live? 75. A great horned owl will live to be 75.
Wow.
And the screech owls, which are a much smaller owl that looks like the great horned owl, but it's only 6 inches tall, they can live. I had one that lived to be 22 and a half years old, and to my knowledge, that's the longest lived screech owl in this country. So they live a long time.
You know, as an aside, first of all, I want to identify this is it's 7:34 and you're listening to KZYX. This is Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner here with my guest, Ronnie James. Talking about owls, I can imagine you're familiar with the book Wesley, the remarkable love story of an owl and his girl.
Yep.
That was just a
wonderful,
amazing
story.
Amazing book. Yes, and so it gave me a whole insight into owls that I had no idea. Well, they're all wonderful, the creatures, of course. How is all of this, all those cages? I mean, in the beginning, I think you just paid for things out of your pocket.
I did. I did until someone came to me after I'd been doing this for about 3 years, and he pressed a $10 bill into my hand as he handed me this little owl. And I tried to give it back to him, and he said, "Oh no, these owls don't, you know, you don't have to bear this price. These owls belong to all of us. We should all pay our fair share." And of course, since then, there's been many more birds besides owls and many more animals. I've been fortunate to have had everything from bears to opossums. The only thing we haven't had is a mountain lion. But we have had everything else. And basically, the community stepped up, and I put out a newsletter twice a year, and the community sends money, and the money goes directly to pay for all of the expenses around the animals. We don't have any paid staff, and volunteers, the veterinarians volunteer their service. In Mendocino, Karen Novak has volunteered her services for many years.
Do you give out your phone number or some way that people can get in touch with you? Obviously, they need to be able to do that when we do find an animal.
I don't give out my phone number. After many, many sleepless nights with telephone calls all night long about seals on the beach and owls in the trees, I can be reached through any of the veterinarians in up and down the coast. They all know about me. Department of Fish and Game, Police Department, Fire Department, they've all know how to contact us.
Okay, so those are the ways. There's not an email address?
There is an email address. Doesn't get answered in the middle of the night, but it's, what is our email address? woodlandswildlife@mcn.org.
Of course, you don't come out and do anything.
No.
So somebody has to bring the creature to you if you can take it. And, of course, that's all established by phone ahead of time. Where else? There's a place, isn't there, in Santa Rosa? Aren't there some other numbers that might be helpful?
There's an excellent bird rescue in Santa Rosa called Bird Rescue of Santa Rosa. And Sonoma Wildlife, which is in Sebastopol. And Wild Care in Marin, San Rafael, actually. Those are the three places that we work the closest with. It's reached the point where often we get animals that I can't handle. Either they're too big or they have injuries that we can't handle here on the coast. And we do a lot of networking with these other facilities. Everything has to be released where it was found once it's better and it can go free because it has a home and possibly a mate or a family, and it knows the territory. And we will frequently have to take things down into the larger facilities where they have avian surgeons. And we just had a fox that came in. It had been dragging a leg hold trap around with it. And he went down. The person that found it took him down there for us. I wasn't here at the time. And they were able to amputate the leg, and the fox is recovering, and will be back, will be brought back up here to be released on this gentleman's property, because that's its home, and it's going to do just fine.
Really, with three legs?
With three legs. A fox can get by, not if it's a front leg, but if it's a back leg, a fox can get by just fine. So, yeah, we work really closely with these other places, and it's always been amazing to me. I came from a competitive kind of world, and then I moved up here and discovered wildlife rescue, and it's not a competitive sport. All the other facilities are very welcoming and anxious, and we all work together, and it's nice to be part of a network. I recently went to a conference in Portland and was able to meet people from all over the United States and Canada who do this kind of work. And it was really a wonderful experience. I learned a lot from all of the classes that they had. But aside from that, just meeting other people that have the same problems and the same joys and the same insights, it was really nice. I think working in Mendocino and being the only facility up here, it's very isolating.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that it is.
Yeah, it was good.
You're able to tune in to the animals so much and respect it and understand that it needs peace and quiet, and anyhow, it's wonderful. I don't know. Do your volunteers I suppose they come to that place, but it seems very innate if, from your writing, in you.
It's a difficult place to come to. I think we as human beings, we're very nurturing, but we want to nurture things in the same way that we would nurture our own species. And that is exactly the opposite of what you have to do for animals. And it was a hard lesson to learn. But people do come to it. I mean, eventually, if they've worked closely enough. And you learn some really special things. You learn how to read an animal's body language, and you learn how to, I can understand what birds say when they're chirping. Even though they have no language, they do have communication skills. Mm-hmm. And it took 26 years to get there, but I know my other people have said the same thing, and other rehabbers say that. You learn to read the body language and the sounds that the animal makes.
Huh. Some of the things that were so interesting to me is that you didn't want the baby to, not see you, so it wouldn't...
Imprint,
yes. Yeah. And that you put a mirror out so it could see itself, and all sorts of things. And then there's this wonderful story that you're not going to read about Jacob the otter. And how big was the otter when you got him?
Just about 4 inches long.
Oh, how amazing.
It was amazing.
Well, people can buy your book and read all these wonderful stories. But the affection that he felt toward you is like a puppy. He just wanted to be cuddled and kissed you on the face. And
I was mom, you know. I had raised him. And at that time, I was unable to find any other facility in the United States that had a baby otter so they could be raised together so that he would grow up knowing he was an otter. And essentially, if you raise an animal, a baby animal, it will think of you as its parent, but it will also think of itself as a human. It doesn't understand that it's what it is. Its image in its brain is of whoever raised it. And essentially that ruins that animal's life. It can never go out and find a mate and have a successful life in the wild. It will always come back and seek human company. And many times animals, if they're imprinted like that and they seek human company, what happens is a human that is not as compassionate or understanding will kill it or do something really harmful to it.
Right, yeah. In your book, there's a section of photographs, colored photographs, that are really lovely. When you released Jacob, went to some place in Southern California, right?
Coyote Point Museum in South San Francisco.
Oh, not so far. He remembered you. And he climbed up into your lap, and it looked like he was kissing you on the face.
He did.
Yes. Oh.
I had to give Jacob up when he was 3 months old. And why I had to give him up was there in the book. And I was able to place him at Coyote Point Museum, where they have an otter exhibit, and it's a little zoo just south of the San Francisco airport. And I was heartbroken to have to give him up. Of all the animals that I've ever raised and set free, it's always a joy to let them free, to be what they are. But it wasn't a joy with Jacob, because I loved him so deeply. And he couldn't ever go free, because he was so imprinted on human beings that he was dangerous. So you take any wild animal, and as an adult, it becomes very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Even something as dear and sweet as Jacob was. Mm-hmm. And I waited a whole year before I could go down and visit him at Coyote Point. And they kept him in his cage, and then they let him out to romp around in this big room in the back room of the zoo that none of us ever see. And I was standing over in a corner, and I just whispered his name. And I saw him stand up straight and just literally fly through the air and leap into my arms and cover me with otter kisses. And it was obvious that he remembered who I was.
It's such a wonderful story. You know, I am thinking that if people would like to call in, that would be good. And would that all right with you?
Sure, I'm happy to answer questions if I can.
And the number is 937-5103. So please do call in if you have a question or comment. You have something else maybe you'd like to read? Is
sure.
this a good time for that?
Okay.
At some point, I think you have some things in the back of the book and information maybe that you want to impart, but please do go ahead.
Well, shall I read something shorter or longer here?
Well, longer is fine.
Okay, we'll try Rosie O'Coon. Everybody has a raccoon in their yard, so everybody will be able to relate to Rosie O'Coon. It was September when Park Ranger Munson knocked on my door. He and his family lived nearby at Van Dam State Park, and his boys had an infant raccoon some campers had been observing for 2 days. It was at their campsite when they arrived, and they left it alone, hoping its mother would retrieve it. Most wild babies are born in early spring, so there will be plenty of food and warm weather over the summer while they're growing up. About 2 weeks old, covered with fleas, ticks, lice, dirt, and her own excrement, Rosie was a very late baby. Her eyes were just opening, but she could see well enough to hiss at me as I reached into the box to lift her from the nest of pine needles Ranger Munson had made. She gave one more little growl and then lost all interest in defending herself as I squirted a few drops of warm kitten milk formula into her mouth. She was 5 inches long and had no teeth. Within minutes, she was sucking greedily at the 2-inch baby bottle fitted with a tiny nipple. I combed her with a flea comb each time I fed her. It took 3 days to remove all the fleas, lice, and their dirt. Flea powders and other products are likely to kill wild babies. Every time I handled her, I put on latex surgical gloves and a disposable paper smock to avoid picking up not only the wildlife inhabiting her, but the raccoon roundworm, which I can't say, bacillus something or other, which can be fatal to other mammals, including humans. Now, the goal of every wildlife rehabber is to release the client healthy, healed, and able to reproduce in the wild. We rarely know if we've been successful, but Rosie was an exception. Late one evening in July, as I sat reading on the living room sofa, a movement at the sliding glass door caught my eye. I looked up to see 3 pair of shoe button eyes peering in at me. There was Rosie with 2 pups. I couldn't contain myself, and I went to the door for a closer look. The pups hid behind Rosie, but Rosie put her paw up to my hand on the glass. I opened the door a crack and handed her a hard-boiled egg. After a few minutes, they all left to continue their incessant hunt for food, and I only caught glimpses of them as the family left their den and went about being raccoons. The pups grew and toward late fall wandered off to explore the world on their own. Rosie is 6 years old now, and the visit repeats itself every summer. She never comes twice in one summer, nor does she come without pups. I have no other contact with her, and I'm satisfied she is a successful raccoon, and I am a successful human, and that's how it should be. Of course, I skipped about 8 pages there about what it took to raise Rosie to be a raccoon.
Well, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, the big part, the hard part.
Yeah, well, what were some of the challenges?
Well, It was problematic because we couldn't find any more baby raccoons to raise her with because she was such a late baby. Everybody else was grown up. And so she was raised essentially by humans. But we also know that there's an age where raccoons go through raccoon puberty. And much like our human experience, they become very independent and want to leave and go do things on their own. And sure enough, I withdrew all of my my presents from Rosie and forced her to go out in the world on her own. Of course, she lived in my backyard under a big brush pile so I could see what was going on. And she was reluctant to give up contact with me, but eventually she did because her hormones were telling her that she needed to go be a raccoon. If I had continued to be with her and to keep her as close to me as she had been after she had gone through puberty, that would not have happened. She would not have been a wild raccoon. And adult raccoons, even though they're real sweet and they'll come up and take food out of your hand if you've done that with them, they're very dangerous. There's also a quick story in here. which I can't find at the moment, but about some people who raised a baby raccoon and were riding around with it in the back of their pickup truck. And it would ride around on their shoulders and wasn't this fun until they stopped at McDonald's and they brought their hamburger back in the car. And the raccoon thought that was just, you know, the raccoon wanted the hamburger and proceeded to take it. And the boys had to go to the hospital and get stitches in their hands where she also tried to eat their hand along with the hamburger. And you can't blame the animal for that. That's just the animal being what it is. So mm-hmm. all adult animals become unpredictable and dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is Women's Voices with Ronnie James. If you'd like to call in, the telephone number here is 937-5103. You must have a list of things, of do's and don'ts. Hi, good evening. You're on Women's Voices. Hi there.
It's been an interesting show. I know Ronnie and I live in the same area, and it's been fascinating to learn about her background and what she did before she became the famous savior of wounded animals. But it was very interesting, and she reads well, and I just say bravo. I'm glad she's part of our community. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's lovely. Thank Goodness. You. It's lovely. And it's true. You've brought so much with you. But to go back to what we were talking about, for instance, to leave a door open of the... Oh, here we are. Well, this is lovely.
We'll get there.
Hi. You're on Women's Voices.
I wondered if the imprinting that takes place that is such a problem with the wild animals... What is it about the domestication process in cats and dogs that make it so they can still mate and raise offspring and such things, even though many of them are raised entirely by people? I just think that's a fascinating idea, and if you could expand on that a little bit. Thank you.
That's a great question. Thank you.
It is a good question, and I don't know a lot about cats and dogs. What I do know is that if we could have domesticated the wild animals like the possums and the raccoons and the skunks and deer, if we could have domesticated them and made good pets, it was something that would have been done centuries and centuries ago. And that there is something about dogs and cats that lends them to being good pets. Wildlife just never makes good pets. It wild animals do not ever give up the instability that comes with being wild. There's always that funny little wild thing in them, and you can't rely on that to not come out at the wrong time.
They won't be dominated, right?
That's part of it, yes. That's part of being wild. And you can never tell what they're going to interpret as a threat and simply react to the threat. There's a story in the book about a woman who had raised a baby weasel. Sweetest little thing. As a matter of fact, she called it Weasel Baby, and it used to sleep on her lap. And I really tried hard to get her to give that up, give up the weasel and let it be whatever it needed to be as it was an adult. And they just loved their pet weasel too much, and they loved it very much until it was asleep on her lap, and all of a sudden it just jumped up in the air and took a big chunk out of her arm, and she had to go to the hospital and get some stitches. It was that big a chunk, and this animal was only 7 inches long. It had a bad dream, and it just leaped up and bit her.
We have 5 minutes left here. Are there things that you'd really like people to know that would help them? I guess we were going back to the keeping it open. If a raccoon is in your house, don't try to chase it out. As I have tried to do.
Oh, there are tricks to getting animals out of your house. That's a good point and a good question, Janie. Skunks get in the house. If you leave your door open at night or a window open at night, they'll be attracted into the house. And I tell people, just make a little trail of raisins out to your front door out the window, and they will leave on their own if you leave the room. You can't stand there and wait for them to leave. And you can't stand by the door with the door open and expect them to come towards you to get out of the house. You have to leave the area. Just make a little trail. hummingbirds in the house, take something red and put it right in the doorway. Open the door or open the window and put something bright red there, and the bird will come down and be attracted to the red and fly out the window. Maybe not on its first try, but at some point it will exit the window. But there was something I really did want to tell people, if we have a minute left.
Yes.
And that is that Woodlands Wildlife has been invited to sponsor, and we are sponsoring, a program called Being with Wolves. And it's this Sunday, June 9th, at 1:30 at the Little River Inn at the Abalone Room. The Little River Inn has donated the Abalone Room, and this is a person that's coming over who works with the Felidae Foundation, which is essentially big cats. And they have funded her to come over and do a wolf program. Wolves were reintroduced in Yellowstone Park in Idaho in, I think, 1995. And recently one appeared in Northern California about a year ago. And I understand it has since left, but there are wolves in this country again. And this woman is coming to give a program on wolves, learn the facts and the myths about wolves. That's this Sunday at 1:30 at the Little River Inn.
That sounds lovely. Is that a free event?
It is free, yes.
Uh-huh. That sounds wonderful.
Now, this is the adult program. She's also going to be going into the schools and doing a different, slightly different program geared for younger children.
And, of course, that's what you've been doing all of these years, is doing adult children's education as well as adults. Is that correct?
Yes, Woodlands Wildlife goes into the schools. A few years ago, we were very fortunate to be able to hire a naturalist, Sarah Grimes, and she does all of our school work, all of our school programs.
So you talk about different animals. Do you bring animals to the schools?
No, we do not have. In order to keep the display animals that you see with that people bring into these programs, are special animals that they've had for a long time, but it takes a very special permit that costs a lot of money to be able to take those. They're called display animals, and we don't mm-hmm. have that permit. Mm-hmm. We're not into that kind of thing.
One of the other things is, if you find a baby something or other, what's the rule of thumb?
Well, hopefully leave it alone until the parent comes back. If it's a fawn, if it's a bird, you can actually try to put it back in the nest. Birds don't have any sense of smell, or most of the birds don't have any sense of smell. Vultures obviously do. And they can't count, so you can just stick the baby back in the nest. If those things are all impossible, try a veterinarian and see if the veterinarian can give you our phone number and bring it in.
And also, kind of, do you want people to remember where they found it?
Absolutely.
So that's kind of key, too.
It is. When things grow up, they have to go back where they were found. And one little tidbit of information, birds don't drink milk. If you find a baby bird, please don't try to give it milk. And cow's milk is toxic to everything but cows.
Thank you. Thank you, Ronnie. It's been wonderful having you on Women's Voices. I've so appreciated it.
It's been lovely. Has it been fun?
It has been fun.